Hello and welcome to News Roast. I'm Jolyon Rubinstein.
And I'm Hayden Prowse.
And this is Three Courses of Conversation.
Jolyon, no, hold on. I don't think we should do the metaphor again. This is episode what?
Well, it could be episode one. Depends the way you're looking at it.
I just think let's keep it really simple. We've done the metaphor every single episode. Let's just say we're having a metaphorical meal where our guest brings some courses for us to discuss.
It's a bit
That's
for
it.
Us like
That's
going
it.
To that.
We don't need to go
but
into
But what
it.
We're doing is we've sort of now this time, we've sort of reached the metaphorical gates of comedy heaven.
We've reached peak metaphor.
The peak metaphor and the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
Not only has his time trumpet blown through
there
our lives.
See how many
years,
show names you can get into this introduction.
But on every hour, it was. I realised that today was the day that I'd actually finally meet the Armando Iannucci show and potentially even...
Very good.
Could I just say I haven't eaten because I thought there would be food.
Shit.
Well,
can we get some Kit Kats in here, please?
Can we get any strange biscuits?
So our guest today is none other than Armando Iannucci,
which
we're very excited about.
It is I.
It is the satirical comedy gatekeeper of our lives.
I love satire. Don't you love satire?
God, is it dead? I don't know.
I
That's the only thing people
I love punching
up.
Yeah. A poke in the eye to them that deserve it. I love it.
Anyone
give them what for.
Who's ever seen any of our work will know that this man and his body of work are not only absolutely inspirational to, I think, anyone who is interested in satire, but basically formed an impenetrably brilliant barrier to entry for any new ideas.
Yeah,
so pretty much most of our stuff is
crap
regurgitation. Yeah. Of ideas
no,
that
I've done
out.
That. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I can only apologise.
Well, yeah,
for
being
what
so
I've done.
Bloody brilliant and prolific. Yeah. So,
am I meant to challenge this? I should challenge it, otherwise it makes me not look humble.
So you think your own work is shit? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, whenever I start a new project, I do think this is going to be the biggest pile of cack ever. Well, I have managed to shake that off.
You just told us that you weren't sure how Death of Stalin was going. You were like, oh, I don't know.
No. Yeah. No, I'm not sure about it.
Still.
So I am kind of sure.
Fantastic, by the way.
Meant to be kind of difficult in a way. You know, it's meant to be funny, but I would like it if most people at the end went...
I think we actually went to see
what
it.
I did.
Yeah, we went to see it with a couple of people, maybe who are slightly, less sort of political geeky than us. And I think there was spoiler alert, some people die in a pretty terrible way at the end.
Yeah.
And it is a strange thing. You don't know whether to sort of laugh or cry. So let's start talking about your body of work in a sort of upside down, backwards way.
Okay.
And start with the death of Stalin.
Metaphorically.
Which for me, certainly, it's the situation that brings the comedy. It's so absurd.
Well, it's based on true stories. Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of the incidents in it actually happened. It opens with a concert where Stalin rings up and asks for a recording, and they aren't recording. It's going out live. And the guy, Paddy Considine, has to just more or less lock the doors and make everyone sit down and make the orchestra play it again, and the conductor faints. Yeah, it happened. And they get another conductor in from outside who does it in his pajamas. That happened. In real life, the first conductor they got in from outside was drunk. So they actually had to get a third conductor
That's
in.
Amazing.
But I cut that because I just thought no one would believe that.
Yeah.
But all the incidents in it, did take place. I mean, what we've done is obviously...
You're literally having to self-censor your satire.
Yes, I know.
Because of just how bizarre the world is.
That's the, lettuce falling off behind Theresa May. Mm. I mean, that's so easy.
I know.
That's route one.
I was about to say, I'm loving your latest work, by the way.
Yes, all of
you are writing Brexit, right?
Yes.
That is one of yours.
And I'm sorry it has jumped the shark.
I mean, you've gone a bit overboard, I got to say.
I thought, I could die any minute, so just put everything in.
Just shove it all
just
in.
Just shove
there.
It all in.
Amazing.
No cuts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There are some sort of amazing lines that you've written recently for Boris Johnson.
Oh, fantastic.
That, I mean,
along the lines of...
followed by death in Libya on the kid bodies. Yeah. I mean, it is a ridiculous situation. But let's take it right back. I know that you've been doing... And I'm sure a lot of our listeners who are big fans, as we are, of people like James O'Brien and Scroobius Pitt would have heard you talking on those. So I'm going to talk about stuff that's really relevant to Hayden and I. And I vividly, vividly remember the first time that I heard On the Hour. And it was about dogs at Christmas.
Okay.
And dogs being thrown onto motorways. And there was a prank call right in the middle of it,
uh-huh.
Which is quite extraordinary. So first of all, how did that come about? And how did you and Chris Morris, who are very, very different sort of people generally, how did you guys meet and start working together?
Well, you must have been about two when you
I was actually, I was two, there's a two-year-old listener of On The Hour.
Having two-year-old.
Always.
No, well, strangely, Chris and I got in touch with Chris when I moved down to London and I had a job at, as a BBC comedy producer, and they put me on a course, a training course, along with other radio reporters and presenters. And it was a week of how to make a magazine program and how to make a news program. And I thought, well, I don't want to do that. I'm here as a comedy producer. So why don't I get them to do like a spoof news show? Since they know how to do it, I can just steal that expertise and get them to do it. And I made a little 10-minute tape. And that then I gave that to the boss of the light entertainment department at the BBC. And he said, oh, we should pilot this properly. And that became On The Hour. And at that point...
How old were you at this point?
Yes, I was 15.
He was only two
I know. I was, what, about 25, 26, something like that. And I remember when I moved down to London from Glasgow, there was a guy on the radio on Saturday mornings on GLR, as it then was, which is BBC London, called Chris Morris. And he had the Chris Morris Breakfast Show. And he was funny, but he also did spoof news items and weather reports and, and DJs and all that kind of thing. So I just wrote to him. And he has quite an authoritative voice. So I thought he was about 59 or something like that. And we met up and we were roughly the same age. He was a year older than me. We met at the BBC. He couldn't find anywhere to park his car, so I just got in his car and we literally drove round Broadcasting House for 2 hours.
Just chatting.
Mapping out.
Amazing.
On the hour. And we both had very similar backgrounds and really into comedy, especially radio comedy. And very, very quickly in this car, literally and metaphorically circling Broadcasting House, we came up with a format for On The Hour.
And then came the day to day.
Yes. Which... So that was, yes, the TV version.
Of course.
And we decided what we wouldn't do is just take On The Hour scripts and rewrite them for telly. We would approach television the same way we'd approached radio, which was harder because we were both radio fans and we'd never made any television before.
I mean, it's so seminal, that show, and so many people that came out of it, from Stuart Lee to Herring to Steve Coogan to everyone. It was the birth of so much of what is now British satire and satire globally.
And the bedrock on some level of a type of British absurdist comedy that completely moved on all comedy after that. Yeah. And I think that's something that might be quite weird.
Well, it was so absurdist. It was so absurdist. It's like I was watching it before we came down. I forgot just how mad it was. Because often with satire, people, they tend to sort of like try and do a riff on a piece of news that makes a kind of satirical point. But like the stuff, it was just complete insanity. It was like, it was just bizarre. It was like, it was on, you know, it was hitting comedic points, but it was...
I mean, what I kind of liked about it was that we weren't all one gang, do you know what I mean? We all came together for the show, and therefore it kind of created its own voice. It wasn't like we had a uniform voice that we then just wanted to translate from a stage show onto the radio. It was more getting lots of different people of writing styles and comedy backgrounds to make something that was kind of radiophonic. And I suppose that was one of the first shows that was aware of the medium it was operating, or the jokes were about the sound rather than just
about the format, of radio, and then with the day-to-day of a news show.
Yeah.
It was a satirical version of that.
I don't think we could have made the day-to-day if we had worked in television for a while. Do you know what I mean? We would have known too much.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of it was just our shorthand way of making stuff.
Paid.
Yes.
Can I tell you about a new audiobook from astronaut Tim Peake?
I love that guy.
The number one best-selling author of Hello, Is This Planet Earth, is out now.
Yeah.
So the audiobook is read by Robin Ince.
Robin Ince, he's a cool, fun science comedian guy. I like him.
Yeah, Infinite Monkey Cage.
Yeah.
Absolute Don.
Mm.
So Ask an Astronaut is Tim's personal guide to life in space, based on his historic Principer mission and thousands of questions he's been asked since his return to Earth.
Mm.
So basically what happened here was that the public were invited to submit questions using the hashtag Ask an Astronaut, and a selection are answered by Tim in the book, which will be accompanied with illustrations, diagrams, and never seen before photos. So what were some of the questions?
Some of the questions were, how does it feel to orbit the Earth 10 times faster than a speeding bullet?
Wowza. And what was it like to eat, sleep, and go to the toilet in space?
I don't even want to think about what it's like to go to the toilet in space.
That's not nice.
It's like Glastonbury if someone were to kick over your port-a-loo. And where to next? The moon, Mars, or beyond?
So Tim is pleased to announce that, as with his previous book, the royalties received from the book will be donated to the Prince's Trust.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, the audiobook is available on CD and digital download now from Penguin Random House Audio. Well, listen, for listeners, just to be super clear, I could ask questions about Veep, the thick of it, In the Loop forever, but this man has had to do this for weeks on the promo trail, so we won't today because we're going to go in to talk about his courses. So, Armando, what have you brought us for our metaphorical starter?
Your metaphorical hors d'oeuvre. Slash aperitif, slash amuse-bouche, whatever.
Crudité.
Crudité. Donald Trump is not an idiot.
Ooh, controversial.
Discuss.
Ooh. I couldn't tell when you sent that over whether you... I mean, is this a position you actually
have? He's not an idiot. He's mentally ill, but he's not an idiot.
Oh, okay.
I think the problem is that we regard him as stupid and a moron, as Tillerson said. And he can't be. To get to where he is, it has some kind of genius. I mean, it's a very specific genius.
Can't he just have had a lot of people around him?
But he doesn't like people.
Yeah.
Especially people around him. He doesn't like that. He just likes him. Mm. That's all he likes. Him and things that he has, people he has made through his own bodily functions and
fluids.
It's like
a great white shark in a way, you know, he's very good at one thing.
Yeah. And it's selling himself.
Absolutely.
Or selling an idea.
Is he very good at one thing?
I think the problem is,
yes, he is.
The amount of failures the Trump organization has had, failed universities, failed hotels.
But that's not it. It's himself, though. He still survived and has got more successful. How successful can you be than being president of the United States? You can't get more. It's the definition of success.
I think it's difficult for people who haven't lived in the States. Yeah. I lived in New York for a year and there was a family where I went to visit, quite a poor working class New Jersey family who were really proud of their like Trump steak knives.
Yes.
And I think it's really difficult sometimes for people in England to understand, you know, how Trump is perceived.
Yes. And also, I mean, not only is he, a billionaire, has been famous for the last 30 years, but a huge television reality star, huge celebrity in that.
You know what a good producer can do, though. I mean, having worked in TV all these years, you must have worked with some morons in your time.
No, but it's more than that. I think he has a genius in understanding how a certain section of society, American society, a big enough section of society, can buy into him. Mm. And the fact that, you know, if you speak to his supporters now and say, well, he hasn't achieved this, he hasn't done that, they say that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's the very fact that he is the president that is enough.
It's interesting that he is. Yeah.
It's what that says to the establishment makes us happy.
Yeah. I mean, all the criticism of him being stupid is coming from the establishment. In a way, I think the media is kind of undermining itself by making that its single criticism of Donald Trump and focusing on sort of irrelevancies, you know, like, you know, going to Puerto Rico and throwing paper towels into the crowd of hurricane survivors. I mean, fine, it's a bit insensitive, but they're undermining themselves by making that their only point.
And they allow him the opportunity to say, you know, those people in the media who are laughing at me, they're laughing at you as well because you voted for me.
Yeah.
And that is the problem, I think. And he has an instinctive, I mean, for all the humour that we get out of his tweets, his tweets are, I wouldn't say carefully judged because, you know, the whole point of them is that they're not. But I think he knows what he's doing. I'm not saying it's a Machiavellian, you know, in real life, he's actually very quiet and very kind of bookish and this is a pretense. It's not a pretense. But I think he has an instinctive feel for what is the right thing to say in a tweet that would rile the people he wants to rile, but that would get the approval of the people he wants to get the approval
of. Yeah, I think he's just a genius of dead cat politics.
Yeah.
You know, like what he'll do is it's like, you know, when it was like the ban on trans people in the military.
Mm. Yeah.
Same day as Obamacare is going
yeah.
through.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
when it was like Muslim ban, that was all talked about, you know, over 30 executive orders, you know, closing down like the Environmental Protection Agency, going on at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
And people were like, before Bannon got fired, it was like, oh, it's Bannon. Bannon's behind all of this. It's right. Bannon. It's not Bannon. It's Trump.
Yeah.
Michael Moore came over last year.
Yeah.
And that was the first time where I was like...
And he said he's going to win.
Yeah,
he's
he said win. He was going to win. And he was like, yeah. you don't understand how much it matters that he went into the Rust Belt, he went to those Ford factories, and he was like, look, I'll slap, you know, $2,000 of import tax on these cars. Mm. And it didn't matter that he was racist. And in fact, to some people, that just the racists, surprisingly, you know, loved it. But
That was the delicious icing on the cake.
But why did people like us miss it? Why did we have no idea that this was coming? Or do you think we did?
Well, because we're political geeks. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And we're news journalists or we're whatever. And therefore, we have a set of rules by which we measure things and judge things. And we couldn't see outside that rule book.
Mm.
And he didn't fit that rule book. And therefore, we made him an idiot, a rogue, do you know what I mean? A misfit,
yeah.
maverick.
We were like spelling mistakes in your tweets. Never yeah, going to happen yeah. for you, mate.
And it's the same, you know, I read this fantastic book Tim Shipman wrote about the Brexit debate, kind of all-out war.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, he said actually the Remain camp hadn't quite bought into the fact that people didn't really understand what the difference between the EU and the single market was. And so they were bandying all this about that, you know, we've got to stay in. There's no way we can come out and yet still apply to the single. You know, people just didn't know what all that meant. They just assumed it was the... People have forgotten to explain politics to people. That's the problem. The concepts and the ideals that they bandy about readily, they have forgotten to kind of remind ourselves by what they mean.
Is it that he has this intuitive sense of what particularly Americans in the Rust Belt really want at this point?
Yeah.
Or is it that he just happens to be the right guy at the right time in the right place? And he just happens to be sort of the most foot in his mouth type of dude in the world. And he is slightly racist and he is really sort of regressive.
No,
and it just happens to be that that's the kind of person that
the Rust
Belt
wants. If another kind of crazy shoots from the hip, you know, just says wild things, guy came along, they'd sink without trace. Mm. He has a gift in being able to sell himself and sell what it is. And I think he also has an ability to believe what it is that he's saying, even though he knows what he's saying will probably change in the next week. You know, when it suited him to adore the Clintons, he was on radio and television saying what a wonderful couple they were, you know, when he was a Democrat, how remarkably clever Hillary Clinton was. He sold it with the same amount of passion and connection that he now sells crooked Hillary, the emails and whatever. And he knows that everything he says, he believes, but he believes in it strategically. He believes in it because selling it with that belief at that time is good for what he wants to happen, even though he knows in a month's time he may say the opposite.
Does
thing
he believe it, or does he know that he's? Is he lying, or is he? Does he no, fully
I
believe.
You
what
see,
he
I think he believes in it, right. but you know how you have short-term memory and long-term memory.
Yeah.
I think he has short-term belief,
totally,
in that he totally believes what he's saying at the moment, knowing
like a goldfish.
Yeah,
knowing so he's a bit stupid.
That it,
but he's not. He's genius.
No,
like,
no,
I
no.
think this is our biggest problem. You know, look at the people that we've said are stupid: Nigel Farage, Boris Johnson, you know, Donald Trump. Arguably, what we
George W. Bush.
You know, well, they're intuitive. They seem to intuit.
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan's a great example. And the thing is that there's this weird thing as well, which is that I think what's very difficult for sort of more bookish people to accept is that on some level, the currency of rationality is dead. You know, like these people are operating on a sort of celebrity spectrum and treating politics like Heat magazine, and it works.
And it's to do with effect rather than fact, isn't it? It's I remember it was John in one of John Oliver's shows. He during the election campaign, he showed a clip of a Trump supporter being interviewed saying crime has gone up and people are afraid. And the interviewer saying, no, well, crime has actually gone down. No, crime has gone up.
Yeah.
Well, I think if you look at the facts, crime has gone down. And then he said, no, people think crime has gone up.
Alternative
and that's what's
facts.
Important.
It's alternative,
yeah, it's alternative facts.
This is your lines of all, you know.
And it's that kind of, you know, we don't actually need science. We don't need fact. We don't need events. We don't need proof. We don't need evidence. We just need belief.
Yeah.
And, you know, it goes back to something I remember Tony Blair saying when he justified why he invaded Iraq. He said, knowledge isn't the same as facts. I only know what I believe.
You see, I think that was the beginning of the post-truth era. Yeah, I think that was it. I think we had a brief sort of unexpected oasis of truth.
Yes.
And then it kind of just disappeared with Iraq. Basically, it was gone after that. And people think it started with the current, you know, referendum campaign and Trump, but it started way before that.
And this is the closing down of the civilized mind and back into the dark ages where you know, we believe in witchcraft and all the way up
until just post the Second World War, we lived in that society, didn't we, where it was basically about propaganda over fact. I think that's been the continuous thing over history, not this sort of, you know, constantly referring back to facts and scientists and crazy stuff like that.
But the danger is, you know, with Trump, if we think our way to approach Trump is to paint him like a clown and do a kind of mocking kind of, oh, look what he said today, the idiot. That's just, he's got to get stronger.
Who do you think would win in an IQ test, you or Donald Trump? What
sort of questions would be asked?
I don't know. How do people know their IQ?
I know.
I don't know.
The last time I talked about doing an IQ test, I was 12 years old. Yeah. Remember when you're 12, you're like, oh, I've got a really high... No, I've got a high IQ. That's what 12-year-olds say.
Do you know what? I don't know about IQ tests, but I'll tell you something I do think about Trump that is the thing that really gets my nerves is the reactive nature. Like, you know, we've said for a long time, we're badly missing a kind of Daily Show format, you know, in the UK, The Last Leg, which is great. You know, we've got stuff like that. But whether it's Trevor Noah or John Oliver or Stephen Colbert, even Jimmy Kimmel now, that it's very difficult for them to get away from those tweets, isn't it? Like, it's very difficult. I haven't heard one of them talking about these, you know, the shutting down of the Environmental Protection Agency, for instance. What do you think is motivating a lot of this with Trump? Like, where is it going? Is it going straight towards fascism? Is that how you see it? Or,
well, he would, I mean, people don't consciously get up and say, I think I'll be fascist. You know, it's
fascism, champagne fascist.
Fascism is a phrase to describe a set of behavior and beliefs, isn't it? But authoritarianism, he loves authority. You know, that's why he's so obsessed with not just Putin, but North Korea, China.
Submissive Eastern European wives.
Erdogan in Turkey. Egypt. You know, he loves that idea. And where it's going with him, I think, is it gets into a petty kind of Obama made fun of me 8 years ago. I'm going to strip everything that Obama did. You know, that's how I'm going to piss on that bed with Obama.
Yeah.
And he's so used to being a CEO of his own company where he could just shout at anyone and something's done for him. He can't comprehend that the US Constitution stops that from happening.
Well, that is quite scary. That is verging towards fascism.
So what, so what he would love to do is change the US, or ignore the US Constitution so that he can have total power.
It's a huge, huge moment next November where we have the midterm elections because it's the sort of fulcrum of two potential gigantic things, which is exactly as you're saying, you know, potentially changing the Constitution quite radically to enhance his own powers. Simultaneously, impeachment proceedings at that point could be at a point where, if we don't have a Democratic Senate, there will be no trial regardless of evidence.
But what's concerning is that those who have spoken out about him when he was running for election, I mean, how ineffectual they are now that he's president. I mean, even the two senators, Republican senators, who've said, who've spoken out about him recently, was it Flake and Corker?
Saying the White House is a daycare centre.
That's right, that he's a liar. He's, you know, I mean, what's their plan? It's to not run for re-election, which sounds like a cop-out.
Well, they're just doing it. They're just going out in flames, aren't they? They know they're about to be sacked, so they're like, I've got nothing to lose.
No, absolutely. But all those who, like Paul Ryan, who spoke out against Trump,
is
when
now
he ran,
silent.
It's just going, well, you know, he's just being,
I want to keep my job.
Let's just concentrate on tax reform.
That's maybe the scariest thing, is that kind of coalescing.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you talk about that moment with Obama, because I was doing another record recently and Bridget Christie was just saying to me, like, this is the moment that everyone, you know, everyone thought it was funny. But Trump being humiliated in a room in Washington, she was like, that is the moment that he just changed. He's just like, well, I'll be the president then.
Yeah.
You don't think I can? That's all I'm going to do.
Never trust a politician who can't take a joke.
We were filming in New Orleans at the Republican Party conference and Trump was a super outside, you know, it was Carson was talking before and getting a bigger crowd. And he walked through a room
And there was quite a few people in the first room, and the cameras hadn't set up, and he was with the Secret Service guys, and he was waving, and I sort of walked, because I was hoping our cameras would catch up, and I walked through, and there's just literally no one in this room, really dingy old room, and he was just waving to no one in an empty room.
What?
And you're so... This is so, so mad.
Was he on the stage?
No. When he came down, he was walking out the building.
Because he thought cameras were on.
I genuinely don't think it matters if people are there or not. You know, I think he was just walking through and he was just waving to an empty wall.
Yeah.
And that's like
I think that's someone trapped in their own, you know, their own head, really, isn't it? Where they are king and all-powerful and adored.
Trapped in their own toupee.
Forever. Somebody told me when he used to be at Trump Tower and he was on whatever floor he was and his children were on the floor beneath. And when his children, when referring to him, would point up as if like God up there, you know, with reverence, not with kind of just... And that there's something about that. There's something about, you know, Stalin, for example, called anyone who opposed him an enemy of the people. Mm. And Trump's approach is to say that you're fake news or you're unpatriotic.
Yeah.
And when he starts picking fights with like widows of Gold Star service people, you know, it's extraordinary. He can't take criticism. And I think that's where the undoing, if there is any undoing going to come, it's going to be that he will pick a petty fight with someone that he shouldn't really pick it on.
Kim Jong-un.
Okay, yeah, well,
Little Rocket Man.
Unfortunately, some of us may get caught up in that's the problem. But anyway, so I just think we consign him to kind of clownhood at our peril, really.
Hey, I'm absolutely depressed.
Why?
About accounting, Haid.
That's so boring.
It's so stressful.
I don't want to have to do it.
Well, Haid.
Yeah.
I might have an answer.
Uh-huh.
They're called Tide.
Oh my God, what are they?
Tide are the people who are kindly sponsoring this podcast today. And they're kind of mobile, web, kind of cool banking service. Mobile. That was set up to help simplify how small businesses and idiots like you and me take care of accounts.
Yeah, these sorts of things make a huge difference when you're running your own business. Time is money after all. Anything you can do to free up a bit of time and help simplify your systems makes a massive bonus. That's true.
This is why Tide's so useful. Look, it's got loads of handy tools such as automated bookkeeping, team access, expense management, and you can pay and send invoices quicker.
Go to tide.co/roast for more detail on how Tide can help you and your business.
So look, one of the great things about opening a Tide account is that you don't have to wait around for weeks for approval like a traditional bank. No jumping through hoops or aimlessly going back and forth in mountains of admin.
That's right. Getting set up on Tide takes less than 5 minutes, so it really couldn't be simpler.
So
Tide, you know what? They've been kind enough to offer our listeners a special introductory offer. That's you guys. So go to tide.co/roast and using the promo code ROAST, that's ROAST, your account will be 100% free for the first 6 months. That's absolutely free for the first 6 months with 6 months free transfers, baby.
So after the 6 months, your account will become a pay-as-you-go account with no monthly fees to pay ever.
Ever. For more details, go to tide.co/roast. That's tide.co/roast. And make sure you use the free promo code ROAST. It's not free promo code, it's just the promo code, but it is ROAST, to claim your introductory offer.
Smooth as an absolutely well-filed tax return. Back to the podcast.
Mondo, that was delish.
Oh, thank you. But not quite filling.
No, I think
we need to move on
extra,
to something with a little bit of spice, maybe.
A bit more hearty.
Yeah.
What have you got for your...
Some solid meat.
Well, I'm kind of a pseudo-veggie.
Okay.
So I'll just have one.
Quorn.
Imagine a quorn Trump steak.
Yeah.
Just like
new Trump corn steaks.
Yeah.
They're the best steaks. They're the best almond.
Best. Everyone knows they're the best.
And they look like Trump, which is great. And you can just cut his face off.
Amanda, we've got to move on. What's your main course? Tell us.
We don't argue anymore. We just get offended.
Oh, shut up.
What?
I can't believe you said that. I'm outraged.
I don't feel safe now.
You're in my safe space.
I want you to leave.
I'm off.
Go to Berkeley. Go to Berkeley. And we'll blow up the place. Did you know his second name's Milo? Yeah. Hayden just left and he's come back for Comic Effect.
Yeah. Come back now.
But it's true, right? I mean, how do you feel about this new, you know...
Well, it's not just all the non-platforming and the... Well, you don't say that. I think maybe it's social media because it's so easy for us to unfollow people and to block them. And for us to end up having, you know, having a forum with those who agree with us or who share our cultural tastes,
yeah, nice and cozy,
or our our particular beliefs, or whatever circumstances it is we want to engage in conversation about on that forum, you know. And so it means we consort with like-minded people.
Yeah.
And anyone who comes from outside, it's so easy. And also you have the anonymity of not physically being with them.
Yeah.
So it's so easy to just say, fuck off, or I don't believe you. So much- Get out of here. That's nonsense. And yeah. And I do worry that, you know, that is now turning us into a society where if somebody does disagree with us, we don't say, okay, well, I disagree. This is what I think. I don't know what you think of that, but, you know, let's see where we go with this. And if we don't agree, then fine. Instead of that, we're getting into a situation where we're saying, because you disagree with me, you are wrong. Mm. And because you're wrong, you're a threat. And I'd now like you to leave.
It's scary.
You know, that's the thing that worries me.
There's an awful uniformity to it. And it's funny because a lot of people that do get the most outraged on Twitter, you'll meet them in person. They're lovely and you can have a really nuanced...
I didn't mean it. Sorry, I didn't... I,
oh, you can just have
that.
A nuanced...
Could you unblock me? Could you unblock me? Could you... there was a guy yesterday who he said, I'm sorry, it was a joke.
Oh, really?
When I said I wanted to kill you, it was a joke. Could you unblock me, please?
Oh, God. You
know? I mean, you know, I always try and do it now where I go and look for the Twitter hashtag that I'm against.
Right.
So it was like, you know, vote leave.
Yes.
Really trying to look at that Trump train.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Was a massive one. But also the sources of information that you wouldn't necessarily look at. So InfoWars, for instance, that has become something I try and watch every single day. And it is terrifying.
Really? Yeah.
Because there are these people who now, I think, feel, you know, rightly or wrongly, they predicted Trump, right? So for them, it's like, well, obviously you're going to listen to us because all the experts got it wrong.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, you should listen to us.
I think you're right. It's important that we engage and read about the arguments of those that we disagree with. You know, I mean, when I started as a radio producer, I said, you know, I did the news quiz, which involved me reading every newspaper every day. And after several weeks of it, you realize no one newspaper gives you the whole story. So as a result, we've always daily had The Guardian and The Telegraph. And it's always hilarious comparing their two approaches. But you know that no one paper is going to give you everything. And it's important that you, you know, if you are of the left, that you read The Telegraph or The Sun or the Spectator. And similarly, if you're of the right, that you read The New Statesman or The Mirror or The Guardian. Because it's just important that you can see where other people are coming from. Because in the end, when arguments are resolved, it's usually... like, say, the Good Friday Agreement. It's because they actually acknowledged where their opponents were coming from and that the only way to get them to agree with something was to approach it from their perspective or try and get into their headspace and imagine where it is they're coming from and therefore what would make it work for them. And if you're putting barriers up to other people's thoughts and opinions, you're never going to engage in any kind of compromise or constructive agreement.
Isn't it also that people like you are needed now more than ever? Because it's not, I mean, it's humour is so important at this point. People need to stop taking things so seriously.
I tweeted the other day about how the only time I get abuse is if I make a joke on Twitter about John McDonald.
Right.
And I then got abuse from people saying, how dare you say you get abuse for making jokes about John McDonald.
people take things too literally. I think that we literally need to kill everyone that takes things too literally.
Absolutely.
Do you all agree with that?
Absolutely.
I think should kill every person in the country.
Yeah. Hashtag kill everyone.
Who takes things literally.
Hashtag kill them all.
Kill them all.
It's true, because, you know, for us, we, you know, think that, for instance, talking about immigration is something that it's really past time that the left did a lot more than stop leaving it to the right. And we did this sketch called The Real Housewives of ISIS, which was, you know, like The Real Housewives, except it was ISIS and not Cheshire.
Yeah.
And the most people that were triggered were white liberals. And it became this huge, huge, massive debate. And the point that we were trying to make by even like going towards there was the whole partly... One of the things, anyway, that, you know, Swift through to, you know, yourself and Morris were able to do is you start a debate by making a joke. We're not saying anything's right or wrong. Just talk about
it. The trouble with Brexit at the moment is that none of the parties will actually want to start a debate with each other.
Absolutely
not. It's all, you know, it's Theresa May saying, I'm the only person who can sort this out. It's Jeremy Corbyn saying, no, you're not. I am. you know, and it's the Lib Dems saying, neither of you are, we are.
Yeah.
But they all say it's the most serious thing to happen to Britain since the Second World War. What did we do in the Second World War? We had a government of national unity.
Yeah.
And what did the last election throw up? It threw up no result, right. No support for one main party. I think the message is, why do you not come together?
Absolutely. I mean, we're one of the only countries in Europe that is so averse to having coalitions. I mean, look at the Germans right now, a three-party coalition.
Yeah.
Every government is a three- or four-party coalition. Yeah. And that does seem like it's the future of politics. And I think the humour thing is really important because there's actually a nuance in that kind of humour. It's like the reason that people talked so much about the Real Housewives of ISIS was because they were kind of, in a way, they were trying to understand the joke and where the punchline landed and who the punchline was on.
Yeah.
And that provoked a really important discussion. And our point was that really the punchline we felt on was on this group in the Middle East, in the Levant, or just on ISIS, which were an aberration of what Islam is supposed to be. The joke wasn't on Islam. The joke was on this death cult that was masquerading as an Islamic group. And it was really good that I think people had that conversation. And it's like the John Ronson book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Yeah.
He starts off with this anecdote of this woman, I think she worked for NBC or CNN, I can't remember, and she gets on a plane and she makes this joke where she tweets on her Twitter, she says, heading to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just joking, I'm white, right?
Right.
You could say that was a slightly crass joke.
Yes.
You could have a discussion about where that joke lands, whether it's about white people's arrogance that they never get affected by the problems of the developing world. There are loads of ways to interpret that joke. Point being, she comes off the plane 8 hours later. She has 4,000 messages in her inbox. She's been fired and she's persona non grata in any media institution anywhere in the world.
And it's that
it's like her life is destroyed.
And it's that groupthink that is kind of worrying.
Mm.
It's, and it happens on the right and the left. You know, it's across all. But it's that if somebody somewhere just puts a foot wrong, puts the wrong word in a tweet, just says the wrong thing, there's no... You know, the trial and judgment is the equivalent of if they had killed someone.
Mm.
You know, it's there's no way back.
No, totally.
You know, and there's no sense of perspective.
Do you think this has got just as much to do with the fact that on both sides, the left and the right, the most important thing for any person writing a story is to make it so salacious that people click on it?
Mm.
So actually, that idea of a kind of rational debate on either side just can't exist because the medium's economic sort of driver is now got to be first, got to be fast.
Yeah, I've got a trend.
Yeah.
I've got a trend. And everything is done for, every argument is there for entertainment value rather than factual or rational kind of elucidation. Really.
And how much of it is to do with the character limit on Twitter? If the character limit was 500 words,
God help us all.
Yeah,
exactly. Can you imagine Donald Trump's tweets then? Yeah. Jeez.
Hashtag kill us, kill them all, kill them all, kill them all.
But maybe his arguments would be a bit more nuanced.
He'd end up arguing with himself actually halfway through.
He'd find many more ways to write sad.
Sad.
I mean, sad has been
very, 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 very sad.
It's very, very, all the very.
Do you see sort of any way back for us?
Several, you know, glimmers of light. I thought it was good in the last election that the number of people voting went up and also the number of people registering to vote and vote for the first time, especially in the 1824 community, went right up.
Really
so that
good.
At least said people are waking up to the fact that, you know, engaging in democratic elections is important. It's not something we could just argue out over Twitter or do a petition about. You actually, votes matter. And I think it was because a lot of people didn't engage in the referendum debate and then woke up thinking, I get it. I should have voted, really. Shouldn't I have? Mm. You know, so that's good. I think, you know, to be fair to social media, it does give you that opportunity to fact check and, you know, websites growing up where you can actually now do more research and you can check on what people have said. You can, so it's ultimately it's what we do with it. It's not the medium itself, it's what we do with it.
Mm.
And at the moment, you know, we're too prone to just coalescing around people that we share beliefs with. I once joked, but I'm now getting a little bit more serious about it, that you should set up an app called something like Ponder, where it puts you in touch with people who are the exact opposite of you in certain beliefs, you know, just so that you could actually get some sense of you know, where the other person is coming from.
So, in conclusion, on that one, people need to stop being so outraged on Twitter.
Unless you want to tweet hashtag kill us all.
Well, yes. Well, if they are outraged on Twitter, we should destroy their lives through Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
So any outraged people on Twitter, we should get outraged by it.
Yeah, and send us your postcode.
Yeah, send us your postcode.
Well, we can all assemble.
You're allowed to blur the number, but just give us a rough idea of where it is. Yeah. So yeah. We can send the mob in the rough direction.
And then satirical heavy energy will fall on the house and crush it. Hate.
Yeah.
Can I just tell you before we keep going with the podcast about a wicked new podcast series that we think our listeners might well enjoy?
What is it?
Well, there's a new podcast by Radio Wolfgang called Unburnable about a pretty unique court case coming up in Norway.
Ah, what is it?
Well, basically, two environmental groups, Greenpeace and Nature and Youth, have decided to fight climate change in a completely new way.
Whoa!
So they're taking the Norwegian government to court over their decision to open up the Arctic to oil drilling, something that...
I've read about this already. This is super cool. I haven't done it yet, but I was going to contribute to it, contribute to the legal fund.
Well, what they're arguing is that any oil taken out from these new fields will be what's known as unburnable carbon.
What, because we're just basically about to get to the 2-degree limit and we can't burn anything more or we're all screwed?
Well, we've all discovered, you know, we've already discovered kind of enough oil that if burned will raise the planet's temperatures, as you say, above 2 degrees to a very dangerous level. Mm. So these guys are actually going to go and sue the Norwegian government and are doing so by using Norway's own constitution, which safeguards the rights of future generations to a clean, healthy environment. Against how good is that, by
I
the
love
way?
Those Norwegians. Oh, I hate them. That? Depending on which ones, whether it's the government or the ones suing them. But Norway,
still amazing constitutionally.
It's, really it's brilliant.
I mean, there should be. Why isn't that in our unwritten constitution?
As people that have done activism for years and years and years, I mean, that's the sort of shit people need to be doing at this point.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's incredible.
Suing corporations to basically save us all from the imminent Armageddon.
Yeah, and you can follow their progress because obviously this is a massive legal battle and loads of people from all over the world are behind it. So we'd like you to search for Unburnable wherever you get your podcasts or visit savethearctic.org. That's savethearctic.org to get involved.
I think that was pretty substantial as a main.
Me
too. That was good.
I'm kind of full, really.
Know about that.
Some I could cheese? Always stick in a bit of dessert. Are you more of a cheese fan?
I guess some digestifs.
No.
Some okay.
No. Some grappa.
It's got to be cheese.
Yeah.
Cheese. And some port. Yeah.
You're right.
Maybe a big cigar.
That just sounds like something Farage would have for pudding, which segues nicely.
That's what he has for his breakfast.
Some port. I've won.
Well, some port. Amanda, your dessert is quite Brexity.
Well, is it now? You see? No.
I think this is the whole point.
Okay, here we go. Okay. So my proposed pudding. my hypothetical flambé is it's okay to be patriotic.
Oh, how dare you.
Well, I support the England football team.
Well, exactly, right? So already, you know, you have an instinctive desire for your side representing your country to win. I think that's fine.
Me
and
too.
I think what happens is a lot of people confuse patriotism with like ultra-nationalism. No. And we're so shy of talking about our own country. Mm. I'm not saying at the expense of other countries and doing them down, but I think it's okay to talk about how good your country is.
Yeah.
I'd much prefer Britain to crash and the economy to be in complete disarray and to be right about Brexit.
Exactly.
I got tweeted the other day by this kid because I was complaining about some other tosh that Boris Johnson came out with, and he said at least he loves his country. Do you? Yeah. And I genuinely didn't know to say.
Absolutely.
And it's actually bigger than that because you know, we've both read, you know, Yuval Noah Harari's book Sapiens, and there was this really fascinating guy on the After the Today program on Tuesday. This will come out in a couple of weeks, so you know, a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about how when religions stop being sort of guiding narratives for countries and we don't have this national story, it's generally a very bad thing because a lot of people feel really lost.
Yes.
And within that comes a lot of anger. I think that's what you're kind of getting at.
And I think people feel that they, you know, if they start talking about how they love their country or why they, you know, want to live in Britain, why they think Britain's good, they're worried that they will be mistaken for being right wing.
Yeah.
It was a worrying trend when Andrea Leadsom was on television having a go at some anti-Brexit story, saying, why aren't you patriotic? Mm. As if patriotism was just the preserve of those who support Brexit. Yeah. And I think I got this from, you know, spending off and on 5 years going to America and coming back. And A, I always felt really good landing in the UK just seeing how green it was and actually how, despite the Brexit result, how multicultural it was. Mm. I've spent a long time defending the BBC, and we forget we have institutions like the BBC and, you know, our universities and our theatre, our literature, which is, you know, the envy of the world. But we are too shy to kind of parade it around the world and to declare how good it is. But also, I was aware of the fact that, you know, working in America, despite what Trump says, it's a very generous country. Yeah. It welcomes you. The fact that I could do a show there without someone saying, what are you coming here doing stuff about our politics for? You're a foreigner. How would we feel about if the French came and did a satire show about UK
We'd punch them in the bloody nose. You know,
it's a welcoming country. But the number of countries you go to where if you meet someone from that country, they will mention the name of their country in their conversation with you.
Oh, my
you
God. Totally. Well, you see,
we in Spain, we love to do this. We don't do that. We don't do, we in Britain, we love
to. But I feel like you're talking about one section of society. And what you're kind of talking about is metropolitan liberal elitists. Mm. I don't feel that is the case for a lot of British people.
You don't feel that they're not patriotic? Or?
Well, I feel actually half of Britain is quite patriotic, and people which would traditionally be seen as sort of metropolitan liberal elitists, probably everyone in this room, traditionally aren't. Mm. And it's a post-imperialist thing. It's the guilt for our crimes of our past.
What I'm saying is we all should be.
But this is right. Well, I think you're speaking to the people that aren't. Yeah. But on that point, I wonder, I've always felt this about Jeremy Corbyn, because I like a lot about Jeremy Corbyn, but I don't feel he's remotely patriotic. I feel he doesn't like a lot about this country. And look, I hate a lot about this country, but I don't want to be leader of it. Mm. So I kind of feel like you kind of need someone that loves the rolling hills and wants to celebrate everything British.
But
and
look at the,
I don't think that's him.
Like the Olympic opening ceremony, what people remember from that was like the NHS.
100%.
You know, the NHS.
That's true.
You
know. And he's a big defender of the NHS.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But again, you have to define what you mean by this country. Mm. It's not just, you know, the geography of it and the history of it. Mm. It's that sense we have. I mean, I love this country because it's got an amazing sense of humour. I've managed to base my life on that, you know, because I wouldn't have existed in certain other countries where, you know, it's about other stuff.
Well, you would have
been
killed.
I would have
literally
been killed in some countries. I would have been expected to be a good swimmer in some countries and a good sports person.
You're a good swimmer out of interest, yeah?
I'm an all right swimmer.
You've got a strong breaststroke. Yeah?
That's your backup career.
That's my backup.
Satirist cum doggy pedalist. But hey, I actually think that in a weird way you're playing into part of the problem, because it's almost like going, one, I've decided this metropolitan elite thing is absolute bollocks. It's just total bollocks. It's so simplified. And this idea that everyone else is these kind of like footy hooligan fans who drive in white vans is also total bollocks as well. It's like there is a sort of become this sort of fashionable disinterest in just being positive about who we are. And back in cool Britannia, Oasis visiting number 10, that's when it was super buoyant.
It does exist.
It does exist on a sort of citywide basis.
Yeah.
I mean, I come from Glasgow and everyone from Leeds, you talk about Leeds, Newcastle, you know, so we're happy to kind of extol the great virtues, the wonderful camaraderie and sense of humour, the food of a particular city that we've grown up in, or a region that we've grown up in, Yorkshire or something like that. But we're not, for some reason, we're still inhibited about, because we think that's a sort of a right-wing thing and people will think badly of me if I said, I really like Great Britain.
Yeah.
I really do.
I've been spending a lot of time in Germany recently because I'm trying to find a German girlfriend for the post-Brexit mayhem.
Okay.
So I can get a passport. EU passport.
I mean, I'm fine. I've got Italian blood.
It's true. You're all right.
I'm all right. I'm sorted.
But one of the things that struck me is just how much, I mean, Germans love the British because they see the British as these kind of mischievous, kind of adventuresome types, the sort of like, you know, Francis Drake, Walter Raleigh types who just go off on mad adventures and kind of buccaneers, privateers.
Yeah.
And like, and the sense of humour as well that is innate to that, like having this kind of sense of humour about the world and how you can just go on a jolly good jape. And I found myself being really proud of that
yeah.
in Berlin, talking to people. And even in relation to Brexit, I started to realise that actually all Brexit was an attempt for the British people to have a really good anecdote down the pub. We didn't have to issue Article 50 and set a 2-year stopwatch ticking before we fell off the edge of a cliff. But when it gets to the end of 2 years, boy, are we going to have a lot of good stories to have a beer over. And the Germans would never do that.
But think how glum it's going to be after Brexit. Because we won't be able to blame Europe for anything.
Yeah, it's true.
But I know what you mean. Like, when I lived in New York, you know, people would always be so proud to be kind of like Irish-American or Greek-American. Yeah. They tell you very proudly about it.
Are there any proud British-Americans?
I mean, this is what I mean. I was going to say to
you. Where you celebrate St. George's Day on Fifth Avenue.
Totally. But it is that strange thing because, you know, also when you go to America, you realise how venerated our accent is.
Yes, and I realize, love your accent.
Oh my God, your accent. Oh my
You're Downton Abbey.
Can you say cup of tea? But it's also stuff like, you realise just things like, you know, the basic level of education that English people get is amazing.
Yeah.
And compared to Americans who are doing kind of tick box tests when they're 18, you know, our way of actually making sure that the underdog is celebrated is incredible.
And look how, you know, we're what, 60 million people. Look at our music industry, its influence across the world. Look at our fashion industry, its influence.
Obviously.
Look at our film and TV industry. You know, look at our education, look at our health. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Our inventiveness and our imagination. And yet, we're not allowed to be proud of that in case we're mistaken for being Andrea Leadsom.
And on the other flip side of it, you've also got this really weird sort of thing where people like Aaron Banks, who helped, you know, fund people like Harris Media, who are this small company in Texas who've, you know, did a lot for the AFD, did a lot for Nigel Farage, did a lot for Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. And they're purposefully trying to actually cut the umbilical cord between the left who are unpatriotic and the right who are patriotic. And it sort of brings us back to sort of the first point, which is this sort of grotesque theatre that's being taken on. So how can the left sort of become more patriotic openly, do you think?
Like, well, it's not necessarily, you know, going to the last night at the proms
shaving
and hanging
our heads.
But it's talking positively. And unfortunately, the problem we have at the moment with Brexit is that, as you were pointing out earlier, you know, if you're opposed to Brexit, you end up talking down Britain, saying it's going to be terrible, we're just going to all fall apart, we won't know what to do. And that is the problem. It reminds me of what was enticing during the Scottish referendum was, for once, on the nationalist side, for once, a vision of what Scotland is was presented.
Were you yes or no for that?
Well, I couldn't vote because I was in London. I didn't have a vote.
Yeah.
I tell you what, I was seriously tempted.
If I'd been in Scotland,
I would have been seriously tempted to have voted for independence, especially since Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage were kind of coming down the line.
So you feel they had a nationalist way of selling that idea?
I'm relieved that we didn't, because I didn't want to wake up the next day a foreigner in England. You know, I didn't like the idea of the country where I was born being a separate land from the one I'm living in now. But I can see the attraction.
Yeah.
And we don't have, if you're not part of the, if you're not pro-Brexit, if you're Remain, I think we have to think about how we can project a vision of what Britain is.
Totally. But
Which isn't diluted by saying, but it should have a relationship with Europe.
No,
I mean,
exactly,
I don't get a sense that the French are less patriotic because they're in Europe.
Because they're in Europe.
Or Germany has less sense of what Germany is because it's in Europe. Why do we fall under this kind of mistake of thinking because we're currently in Europe, we're less British?
Yeah. It's exactly that. In order to be patriotic, you can still point out all the sort of misgivings and problems with Brexit and talk about Britain as part of the European and global community. All the stuff you're talking about, all the cultural things you just mentioned, the amazing things we export around the world, are all about us bringing people in, being a culturally open society,
and
taking in different things.
Cameron's problem during the whole referendum debate was he wanted to argue just on economic grounds.
Right,
that
exactly.
It just wouldn't make sense economically really to leave the EU. And most of the electorate went, well, we're not talking about economics. We're talking about something deeper and much more emotional than that.
Yeah.
But why weren't they able to emote about what
Why weren't any
was?
Of us? I mean, you know, I remember talking to people at the time and we sort of initially thought it was a non-issue to the point where we were making a series during it. We didn't even think we were going to cover it until it started becoming obvious to us that this huge sense of national identity being so bound to one side and being so removed from another was, you know, and I suppose it culminated with Theresa May's speech, where she was like, you're either, you know, a citizen of peoples of somewhere.
Peoples of nowhere or citizens of somewhere.
And there's this bizarre, and now you see, you know, far right people in the Bundestag, you know, the you know, a young 31-year-old, you know, prime minister in Austria who's making it cool for the Austrian far right to be involved. Which, interestingly, by the way, last time that happened in the early 90s, I was told by, you know, BuzzFeed special correspondent James Ball, the EU almost fined them for that happening. Now they're welcomed in.
Post-Brexit, there's going to be a massive discussion about what is Britain? What does it represent? And what kind of a country should it be? And if the Remain camp and the left of centre sit that out, they're going to end up in a country that is not them. So they have to participate in that conversation one way or another.
I think what you realise as well when you go to Europe and, you know, is just how much Europeans love us and love this country. Mm. There are so many more Europeans in the UK than there are in Britons and the rest of Europe. They come here, they're just constantly coming over here. Floods, swabs of them.
Coming over here.
Swabs coming over here.
Putting their croissant, really good coffee.
Coming over here, putting their money into our economy.
that is the key to British culture. It's how open we've been. It's, you know, we have this fluke of language which ties us to America, which is obviously a great draw for most of
British
Europe.
History. It was like we were invaded by the Romans, the Normans, the Saxons, the Germans,
the Neolithic people,
Danes.
I was reading today. I'm reading Andrew Marr's book about the history of Britain. I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, he talks about
Andrew Marr's history of Britain.
Andrew Marr's history of Britain. You know, it's and he talks about Joe Chamberlain. And even when the British Empire was at its height, people like Joe Chamberlain, Neville Chamberlain's father, tried to institute tariffs on any country outside of the British Empire. Okay, this is when everyone was a nationalist. Even the liberals were like fully patriotic, right? Yeah. And he tried to institute tariffs. And the idea was, our empire is so big, there is nothing we can't produce or grow or make anywhere in the empire. We don't need the rest of the world. The Americans have got tariffs. Most of Europe have got tariffs. Mm. We need to do the same. We need to consolidate and make the British Empire great. And I just wanted to read this quote from Churchill at the time, who everyone knows was a great European. And it's fantastic. It said, "It would seem to me a fantastic policy to endeavour to shut the British Empire in a ringed fence. It is very large and there are a good many things which we can produce in it. But the world is larger and produces some better things that can be found in the British Empire. Why would we deny ourselves the good and varied merchandise which the traffic of the world offers? Our planet is not a very big one compared with the other celestial bodies, and I see no particular reason why we should endeavour to make inside our planet a smaller planet called the British Empire, cut off by impassable space from everything else."
Oh, wow.
And it's beautiful. Yeah. And he sums it up. We are a global country. We should be a global country. We're one of the most global countries in the world.
I mean, Liam Fox would argue, you know, we are now open to the world, it's just they can't come in. That's it.
As long as his aide can get a hotel room next week, he can pay for it. It's totally fine.
But he's in love with America. That's the thing.
I think that's the thing, though, isn't it? But if you actually think about, you know, that quote, you know, these two great countries, you know, Britain and America, which were welcomed in. So, you know, floods and floods of, like, you know, different waves of immigrants fundamentally changed the country. What is it going to take to get back to that kind of mentality, do you think?
Maybe some kind of closer European Union?
Maybe a satirical programme?
What about a group of nations based in Brussels?
Yes.
A league.
Decisions.
As Catalonia breaks free and as Lombardy breaks free from... There are going to be all these small European nations.
They could all unite.
Who perhaps in some kind of common market. They might
so like a
to.
Champions League of,
yes, of nations.
That
yes.
That's a fantastic
yes.
idea.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, listen, you know, they say never meet your heroes, and we did, and it was good.
It's quite good, wasn't it?
Yeah. So listen, thank you so much
pleasure.
For being on our show. You know, if you've enjoyed this week's News Roast, please go onto the iTunes store and rate and review the podcast. We've had a great time. I hope you have.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.